every 4 years, the process of a primary nomination system reminds us forcefully that this country is a federation of states. A few thousand voters in Iowa, New Hampshire, Maine, essentially determined that those who traditionally vote or wish to vote for one or another of the Democratic candidates for the presidency would have their list rather narrowly limited. Mr. Glenn, Mr. Askew, Senator Hollins, and others were effectively eliminated from the nomination race by the results in those three small states. There are states which have no presidential primary as such. There's a party machinery which nominates and elects the delegates to the national convention. There are states where there is a separate preferential primary which tests voter sentiment, and another list where delegates present themselves, sometimes pledged to one or another of the candidates, but not always so. Each state has the right to set its own date for a primary election vote. And so we have the present crazy quilt pattern, which sees an election campaign for the nominations of the two major parties, which runs from January, really, down to the very date of the campaign, and which gains great coverage for one or another of the major candidates, but which at the same time is clearly not immediately reflective of the will of those who consider themselves part of one or another of these parties. Now, it's interesting that the United States, along with Canada, are the only two major democracies in the world which allow rank-and-file voters, some say, in who will be the nominee for the senior executive of their country. This summer, Israel will hold an election. At large, the country will elect the members of the Knesset. Each party will submit to the country a list of 120 candidates. People will be elected to the Knesset on the basis of the number of how many votes a particular party gets. It is the party who selects the rank in which your name will appear in your party list. It is the party which selects who will be first on that list. And it is the man or woman who is first on the list, who is assumed to be and who in fact will be the nominee, and if the party is successful, the person who will be nominated as prime minister and told to form a cabinet to govern Israel. In Great Britain, Mrs. Thatcher was never elected to be prime minister by the country at large. She was elected to the parliament from her own particular county. During each session of the parliament, the out parties have a shadow cabinet. This is nominated by the members of the parliament themselves and then ratified by a party convention. And the person who is the prime minister in that shadow cabinet is the person who is presented by that party to the country as the person who will be prime minister if, in fact, that party has a majority in the parliament once the elections are completed. Now, this was the system which was in being in the United States during the very earliest decades of our country. It has the advantage of assuring that the person who is elected to administer the country has a legislature with which he or she can work, because they both represent the same party. During the first decades of our own history, congressional caucuses would be held representing the various factions, and they would nominate the candidates for president of the United States and vice president, and these would be the people that would be presented to the country. But of course, our Constitution, structuring as it did the election of the Congress, the election of the President and the Vice President, made it possible for there to be a majority of one party in the Congress and for the president to be from the opposition or an opposition party. And so around during the 1830s, it was decided to change this system, and the concept of a national nominating convention was devised, which essentially gave the power of nomination to the various states and to the various party machineries in those states. And this was the process which remained in force during the rest of that century. Power was taken from the Congress and given to the states. But within the states, power obviously was arrogated to those who controlled the party machinery. Boss Tweed of New York is reported to have said, I'll allow you to vote for the president as long as you allow me to decide who you will vote for. Now, by the end of the century, it had become clear that those who were put forward to as presidential candidates were not necessarily those who represented the will of the rank and file of the party or of the voters of the country. And the Progressive Party and a number of reformers began to agitate for some major changes in the process of which delegates were appointed to these national nominating conventions. And there are two elements in the reform that was proposed. The first was that delegates be elected by the voters, and the second was that delegates have next to their name on the ballot the person whose candidacy they preferred, and a pledge from these delegates they would vote for that candidate at the nominating convention at least through the first two or three ballots. The state of Wisconsin, that stronghold of turn-of-the-century progressivism, was the first state in 1905 to pass laws requiring a presidential primary for the direct election of delegates to the National Nominating Convention. But these delegates were not yet pledged to a particular candidate. In 1910, Oregon passed the first law requiring both elements of this reform. And by 1916, 26 of the states had passed relatively similar laws. What had motivated this concern was not only the recognition of the control of the bosses of the party machinery over the nomination of the president, but also the 1912 Republican National Convention. The incumbent president, William Howard Taft, controlled the party machinery. But obviously the ex-president, Teddy Roosevelt, was much more popular with the country at large. William Howard Taft gained the nomination, and the progressives and the reformers gained a great number of converts to their cause because they recognized two things. First, that if you nominate a person who does not have the support of the rank and file, you can't get him elected. Taft's nomination secured Wilson's election. And secondly, that there ought to be some way in a democracy such as ours for the parties to be far more responsible to the will of the people. But then, interestingly, as is in the way with many reforms, after 1916 and until the Second World War, there was really very little interest in the country at large, either in electoral reform or in the whole process of holding presidential primaries. By the middle of the 1920s, half of the states which had passed these reform laws had rescinded them or repealed them. In 1928, neither Alfred Smith nor Herbert Hoover, the ultimate nominees of the two parties, campaigned in any of the states in which primaries were held. In 1932, President Roosevelt allowed his name to be put up in 11 states having presidential primaries, but he did not leave Hyde Park to campaign in a single one. So the process that we have been watching these last months and will continue to watch through July, this process, which is extensive and expensive and full of tremendous psychological and physical demands on the candidates, is a relatively new procedure in American political history. It dates really to the end of the Second World War. It's responsive to a number of basic changes in the whole nature of the American political system. Since the end of the Second World War, with a massive growth of American population, it is no longer true that the two parties really can arrive at a consensus which satisfies the vast majority of either party. There are always tensions within the parties. Secondly, there has been, since the end of the Second War, world war, a massive distrust growing among the American people about all institutions, but particularly about political institutions. We don't trust, for better or for worse, we don't trust those who call themselves politicians. And so the people want to arrogate more and more direct power to themselves. And there has also been the development of the scientific political poll, which makes it very clear from time to time, depending on how the poll is presented, who are the people who have at least the greatest name recognition among the candidates for the presidency. And then, of course, with television, there's been the massive increase of the impact of the media upon presidential campaigns. All this makes it possible for men, and presumably for women, who are not among the front runners, who are not among those whom the party regulars favor, to somehow mount a campaign and to gain the momentum which would allow them to be nominated for the presidency. And the first man to recognize this was Harold Stassen in 1948. Stassen was represented the young side of the Republican Party. He challenged all comers in a number of the smaller early state primaries, and he was victorious in each one. And suddenly, a man who had not been known outside of his native state was being talked about. There were headlines about him. And he might very well have gained the nomination if he had not made the mistake of challenging the favorite of the party regulars, Robert Taft of Ohio, challenging him in Ohio, suffering here a tremendous defeat from which he was never able to recoup. But in the process, he knocked Senator Taft out of the nomination, and Thomas Dewey was, in fact, the ultimate nominee of the Republican Party. And once Stassen had shown what could be done by an outsider, using the polls, using the primaries, using the monies that he could raise as he developed momentum, others, of course, immediately jumped on the bandwagon and began to follow suit. And this long, extended, strange, crazy quilt primary system does have the advantage that someone who is willing to dedicate the time, the effort, and who is lucky, someone like Jimmy Carter, is in fact able to come from nowheres, Georgia, and gain ultimately the nomination as President of these United States. Now, obviously, every system that one could devise will have its problems. You cannot ultimately adjust happily the needs and the wants of 240 million Americans and come down to one or two people who truly represent the parties and the wishes of those parties. And we have tinkered with the primary system after every election. Every election has revealed new faults. There's concern now that we limit the length of the election campaign. There's been concern over the last two or three campaigns that we limit somehow the impact of the tremendous cost of the campaigns and try and separate out the candidates from too much dependency upon special interest. And so we have made possible federal funding of the campaigns, and we've also limited the amount of monies which any one person, presumably any one group, can give to a single candidate. And I suppose we will go on tinkering with the primary campaign system. The one major radical reform which has been proposed actually creates as many new problems as it solves old ones, and that would be the proposal that there be a single national one-day campaign, presidential primary campaign, in all of the states. This would, of course, assure that everyone's vote would carry essentially the same weight. This would markedly reduce the length of the campaign. On the other hand, it raises new problems. In the first place, it does not give the time for any outside candidate to develop through the smaller primaries the momentum to gain a chance at the election. In the second place, it would be tremendously costly for all who enter. They must enter, must have campaign operations in all of the states. In the third place, it raises the possibility, particularly in whatever party is temporarily out of office, that it will present that 8, 10, 12 people will present themselves for the nomination, and that after the election is over, there's very little to separate between the two. Each has reached 10, 12, 14% of the, has gained 10, 12, or 14% of the votes, and either a single
issue candidate
will emerge with slightly more votes than anyone else, a candidate who probably cannot gain election if he is nominated, or you are forced, in order to find who will be the nominee and not to throw it into a convention which is deadlocked almost from the beginning, you need to have a runoff election, which is the very issue that Jesse Jackson is claiming is so anti-minority, anti, in his terms, democratic throughout the South. So most of the proposals for a single one-day national primary campaign have required a runoff campaign if no one receives a plurality or no one receives 40% of the votes. And it's probably instead of having one campaign, we would have two. And it's not at all clear that this would accomplish much more than is being accomplished now. The campaign, then, for the nomination of the President of the United States is a terribly important one. We forget that most of us get excited come August and September about the national election, but by that time, our choices have been severely limited. And the real chance to make one's needs felt and to give support to the kinds of people one feels instinctively want to support does, in fact, come in the primaries. This present primary, the primary of 1984, has, in my estimation, been rather typical of previous primaries in all respects but one. In the first instance, the incumbent party, in this case the Republicans, have decided not to challenge their first term president. There have been in the past challenges to an incumbent president who can run for re-election. John Garner began to challenge Franklin Delano Roosevelt in 1940 over the third term issue. Henry Wallace tried to challenge Harry Truman in 1948. But by and large, these challenges are short-lived and foredoomed. Because for a party to challenge its own president is to challenge its own platform, is to find itself torn by an internecine quarrel, which becomes vicious because there are a lot of leaders whose livelihood and whose power depend upon the support of the incumbent president. And obviously, if there's a serious challenge, there are a lot of people who are dramatically opposed to those policies. Recognizing that prudence dictates the policies which the Republican Party has chosen, I personally am still sorry that they chose to be prudent. It would seem to me that it would have been far better for the country if the policies of this president could have been challenged not only by the opposition but by his own party, if questions could not have been raised to the degree of control and of competence the president has shown both domestically and in terms of foreign policy. And I think there is a serious issue before the country, and that is whether a man who will be who might be the president of the United States when he is well into his 70s ought, in fact, to be in that high-pressure, high-power office. I remind you that when Mr. Roosevelt entered his fourth term, old man and a sick man, mistakes were made during that term which have had tremendous consequences throughout the rest of history. Because these were the months in which the decisions were made as to the organization of the world at the end of the Second World War, and Roosevelt was not at his top of his powers or in command of all of his faculties in making those decisions. And again, I remind you that when the last several years of Mr. Wilson's administration were disastrous years for our society. Age and illness must be considered, and they're legitimate issues to place before the country. Usually the out party nominates or has an election nominating campaign between any number of individuals. Though a number of individuals run, these people tend to come from a very small band of people in the society. Senators, a few governors, a vice president from a past administration. There have actually only in the last 50 years, there have been less than 130 men and one woman who have been seriously considered as candidates for the nomination by the two parties to the presidency. A very small number will come from very specific places in the society.
And invariably, the out party's nomination campaign is a campaign between someone who has more or less the official imprimatur of those who are in power in that party, often a vice president from a previous presidency, Mr. Nixon in 1960, and again in 1968, Mr. Mondale this year, and others who campaign against this candidate of the center of their party, the authorities of their party, on a new faces, new issues kind of platform. As a country has become increasingly impatient with established authority and with institutions, that line, that rhetoric has become increasingly popular. It brought Mr. Carter to the presidency in 1976. It is a line which Mr. Hart has been following and trying to gain the nomination in 1984. But interestingly, those who represent the major interests of the party and those who would like to play the new issues, new faces line to represent those very same interests tend, by and large, if they are people who have a chance at the nomination, to come and to represent the large central traditional interests of that party. When this does not, in fact, take place, as in the nomination of Mr. Goldwater and in the nomination of Mr. McGovern, that party is usually headed for a disastrous defeat in the fall. And I believe that in the contest between Mr. Mondale and Mr. Hart, you do have, in fact, two men, different in personality, obviously different in temperament, different in character, but two men who do represent the broad, traditional, central interest and approaches of the Democratic Party. If this election were simply between Mr. Reagan on the one hand and whoever was to win the contest between Mr. Hart and Mr. Mondale on the other, we would have a very traditional election year. But the one thing that is different with this election is the campaign of Jesse Jackson. Jesse Jackson's campaign has become one of messianic passion within the black community. He is not the first black to run for the nomination to the presidency and to do so with some measure of success. You may remember that in 1972, Shirley Chisholm ran for the presidency, and she went into the Democratic Convention with 152 delegates. But there's every difference of quality, every difference of emotion between her campaign and that of Jesse Jackson. Today, there's a messianic fervor to the Jackson campaign, which was absent in hers. Wherever Jackson has entered a campaign, there has been a massive registration drive within the black community. 20% of those who voted for Mr. Jackson in Florida and in Georgia had not been registered as voters before he entered those primaries. I was in Columbus a week ago Monday. I was speaking at a conference at Ohio State, and the taxicab driver I had from the airport to the university had on his dashboard a 2 or 3 inch packet of registration cards. He had spent the weekend registering black voters in a number of apartment buildings near where he lived, and he was telling me with great pride of the 300 and some people he had registered for the first time to vote in Ohio. Wherever he has gone, a gospel involving Jesse Jackson has been preached in the black churches, and wherever he has gone, the registration figures of blacks in the American society has increased dramatically. Now, if this were the single element which was most revealing about Mr. Jackson's campaign, we would all applaud. The registration of people and their entrance into the political system is something which everyone who believes in the democracy must covet. But Mr. Jackson has spoken not of entry into the American political system, but of gaining control of major parts of that system. When Jews or other minorities began to move away from their fears about American politics and to enter into the system, they were spoken to by their leaders as people who finally had the chance to take advantage of American opportunity, to share in the American process and the American dream. But unfortunately, Mr. Jackson's approach has been a we and they approach. And he has emphasized in his rhetoric not so much the the opportunities represented by the American societies, opportunities of which he himself is a classic example. But he's emphasized those things which are negative, those things which have been repressive in the society as far as blacks are concerned. And he has spoken to the black community of their need to unite, their need to be a juggernaut to gain the kinds of power which they, in fact, ought rightfully to exert. It's been a we and they campaign, rather than a campaign of entrance into the American political system, a throwing off of the lethargy, a willingness to move up step by step to take advantage of the opportunities which are there. But the messianic nature, the passionate nature of this campaign cannot be discounted. It's there, and it's a fact of political life in America today. Now, Mr. Jackson's campaign has presented a number of problems because of this to those who have black leaders who have won election to major mayoralty seats in this country and to other places where they do exert power. One of the interesting features of the Jackson campaign is that the passion which he has aroused in the black community has muted the questions and the criticisms which a Mayor Coleman in Detroit, a Mayor Young in Atlanta, a Mayor Good in Philadelphia, a Mayor Bradley in Los Angeles, all blacks elected to major office, have in fact had about his person, his qualifications, and his approach. They're concerned on two levels. As men who have faced the electorate, they know that in most places, blacks cannot do it on their own. They need white support in order to be elected. And then as men who have occupied positions of power, they recognize that they cannot administer a city without the support and of large elements of the white community within their community. And so this black power approach, which Jesse Jackson has, in a sense, evoked within the black community, is one which gives them serious trouble. More than this, they are troubled by the person of the man himself. Jesse Jackson now demands that blacks stand up for him, for blacks, as a statement of their manhood, as a statement of solidarity. They know that in 1972, Jesse Jackson did not support Shirley Chisholm for presidency. They know that Mr. Jackson speaks with a voice which is a voice to a certain degree which calls for the arrogation of power to his own person. And they recognize full well that for blacks, for any group to be effective in the society, there must be many leaders, many people who have many positions at all levels in society, that no one can be the broker, the power broker for a community of that size. They're concerned with his megalomania. Many of them know, particularly those who were close to Martin Luther King, that when Dr. King was assassinated, it was Jesse Jackson who rushed off to Chicago to wave a bloody shirt before the television sets in order to draw attention to himself. And finally, there have been all kinds of reports circulating quietly in and out of the black community that in the past, Mr. Jackson's endorsement has been available for a certain sum of money. Those who are close to Coleman Young in Detroit say that, have reported publicly, that he was willing to endorse Mayor Young his first time around for $70,000. So there are questions of character, there are questions of approach, there are questions of the basic philosophy that a minority must take as it seeks to win its rightful place in the American political scene. And there are also questions as to the way in which America should be portrayed to the members of that minority. To Jackson, the American society is one which you largely criticize. He sees it as another colonial power. He's much more forgiving of the sins of those countries outside America which are in the third world, perhaps a authoritarian countries in the third world than he is of the failings of what is really a remarkably open and law-abiding society. And this, too, troubles some. But what is most troubling to me, as a rabbi, as a Jew, is the fact that in this whole campaign, the issue of Jewishness, of Jews, has been made into a central issue. I thought at first that Mr. Jackson's interest in the Palestinian cause, that his involvement with many of the Arab leaders, was in fact a cold and calculating political ploy. After all, the Arab world has been looking for a long time for a polity within the American community to which it could appeal, from which it could draw some support. Here was a way for Mr. Jackson to find dollars for various parts of Operation Push and for his own campaign. And in return, he had to do very little except to speak of the human side of the Palestinian issue, to speak of the, to allow members of the Arab League to speak at the annual convention of Operation Push. But I'm now convinced that it runs deeper and that there's a more unfortunate strain in all of this. And it has to do, I believe, with Good Friday and with Easter and with the fact that Jesse Jackson is a minister raised in and conditioned by the medieval stories of the Passion and the Crucifixion and the roles that Jews play in that Christian story. As early as 1972, Mr. Jackson was blaming the Jews around Richard Nixon. He converted Haldeman and Ehrlichman to Jews in order to make that point. He was blaming the Jews for the insensitivity of the Nixon administration to the needs of the poor and of the black. I think it's not a matter of chance that the supporter of Jackson, who has emerged to gain the most publicity, is a Muslim black nationalist, Farrakhan, who speaks not only of black separation, but who has accused Jews of controlling the media, of distorting the Jackson campaign, and who has threatened the Jewish people as a people if so much as a hair on the head of Mr. Jackson is in fact harmed. Now, one of the untold stories of this campaign is the fact that wherever the Jackson campaign has moved in the black community, the story has gone out that an unspecified number of Jews have been put into protective custody by the Federal Bureau of Investigation because they represent a direct threat, have made threats to the life of Jesse Jackson. Some weeks ago, I met with Mr. Jackson's personal lawyer, and I met and also with a man who is a lawyer for the Jackson campaign. I was interested to see what could be done in order to take this increasingly Jewish element out of a campaign in which, to my mind, it had no part. We talked of many things, but the most interesting to me element in that conversation was the way one of the men came back again and again and again to the fact that he believed that Jews actually represented physical danger to his candidate. He repeated this story, the canard of the Jews who've been imprisoned in order to prevent their attacking Jackson directly. His proof that there was something called the Jews Against Jesse, a creation of the Jewish Defense League. When I reminded him that this Jewish Defense League is an organization of wild-eyed people way out there and not at all representative, he nevertheless continued to speak of this threat posed by Jews. As I've watched Mr. Jackson, I have become more and more convinced that he is caught up in and moved by his religious upbringing, as in fact we all are, but in this case, it has some unfortunate consequences in his attitude towards Jews and towards Judaism. In the crucifixion story, we are the guilty ones.
in the campaign, we are being painted into that corner. In the crucifixion story, it is somehow the Jews who are blind and deaf to the new dispensation which is being offered. America is blind and deaf to a very large degree to the attractions of Mr. Jackson. He has not been able to gain outside of his own community a very large support. In fact, the only group which is enthusiastic within his rainbow coalition are the more politicized Arab American societies. Nevertheless, it is somehow the Jewish issue which has surfaced again and again and again. And the more that Mr. Jackson has tried to explain his Haimi and Haimitown references, the more it is clear that he thinks of Jews in terms that are stereotypic. The more he talks, the more he reveals himself. Let me quote to you from an interview with Mr. Jackson, which was published in Newsweek magazine. Question. You recently said that the record is clear and complete on the Haimitown remark, but could we go over it again? Answer. Actually, this matter was obviously a campaign mistake, and the handling of it reflected the fatigue in the campaign. If one of you had something as derogatory as kike, that's mean-spirited. When you look at the number of Haimans and Haimis in the telephone book, it's clear that that's not an offensive statement with religious or political overtones in our vernacular. It grew and grew to be something now that it never was. It should have been dealt with much earlier, much more quickly, much more, in fact, emphatically. He might simply have said, I said it and I'm sorry. That would have dealt with it more emphatically and more quickly. You seem to have said that Haimi is not a derogatory phrase. Is that true? It's non-insulting colloquial language. So many times we've said, we're going to New York, we're going to Harlem, we're going to Chocolate City, we're going to see Mose and Mosella, which are certain characterizations of black, not quite like nigger, but like so. Do you remember when you first used Haimi and in what context? I think the first time I heard it was when I got to Chicago about 20 years ago. There's a place down off Maxwell Street called Jewtown. Understand? Jewtown is where Haimi gets you if you can't negotiate them suits down. You understand? That's not meant as anti-Semitism. If you can't buy any suits downtown, you go to Jewtown on Maxwell Street and you start negotiating with Haiman and Sons. And if Haiman and Sons show up, they're called Haimi. There's no insult even to them. This thing took on a life of its own. Now that is where it is. That's not where it is. That's where Mr. Jackson is. Stereotyping Jews in a way he would never tolerate anyone stereotyping his own people, and in a way no one should ever stereotype any group of people. It's that old, I go to Haimi town in order to Jew the Jew down. That's really what he's saying. Mr. Jackson has also picked up that popular 20th century version which we used to hear so much from others earlier in this century, some of my best friends are Jews. Now that the version is, as to quote Jackson directly, Zionism is a kind of poisonous weed which is choking Judaism. We have the real obligation to separate Zionism from Judaism. Zionism, Judaism. Some of my best friends are Jews. But if Jews care about the things that Jews have a right to care about, they're Zionists and therefore outside of the pale. Mr. Jackson has been, in fact, remarkably insensitive, though he proclaims himself to be a great minister, a great peacemaker, a great harmonizer, remarkably insensitive to the needs, the rights, the concerns of Jews. He's a man who was quoted by two of his early Jewish supporters, who since deserted, as saying on the plane when he was going to Israel, that famous visit in which he stirred up the Arab masses in the West Bank and hugged and kissed Arafat, quoted as saying, I'm sick and tired of all this talk about Jewish suffering. And he refused to the invitation of the Israeli people who were his guides to visit Yad Vashem. Mr. Jackson has, unfortunately, all the
the preoccupation about Jews, which was characteristic of medieval Christianity. The New Testament knows of three groups, Jews and Romans and Christians. And Jews play a very negative role in the drama of the New Testament, the drama of Holy Friday and of Easter. And Mr. Jackson sees himself, I firmly believe, in the role of a modern savior. He sees the Jews as those who are conspiring against him. He has allowed his campaign, he has not spoken a word during this campaign about this underground rumor about Jews out to do him physical harm. He has made no attempt to correct the impression which is going out in the black community that it is Jews who somehow are making this causing this campaign to fail because he's not getting the kind of press he might otherwise want to have. And I'm very much concerned about the long-term consequences of the inevitable failure of this campaign. For if we play out to this scenario, if I in fact am right, it will be the Jews who are blamed for the failure of the campaign when it inevitably fails come next July. It seems to me that there are two long-range consequences of the Jackson campaign, both of which are unfortunate. The first is that he has allowed Farrakhan, and to a certain degree, and to a very large degree, by his own absence of moral integrity, he has allowed anti-Semitism to become an issue, a live issue within the black community. The black community is a believing community, is a community which knows the Passion story, is a community which has no reason to look upon the Jew as the enemy, but it has all of these old immemorial memories which are evoked whenever the New Testament is read. It's a believing community. It's a community which can be churned up. Mr. Jackson and his campaign are, in fact, doing so. And the second consequence, which is of concern to me, is that a new link seems to have been forged between the Arab world and the black world here in the United States, a politically based link, money for political support, a link which many in the black community will be pleased to follow for two reasons. First of all, they object to all monies which go abroad for foreign aid and otherwise. It is easy to say to them, these are monies which are taken out of the real domestic needs of our own country. And second of all, the Arab world is pictured to them as part of the third world, their world somehow, not our world. And the emergence of the third world is seen as a fight against colonialism, the same way their emergence in America is seen as a fight against colonialism. What the long-range consequences of these two events may be, it's too early for us to predict. The black community is not a community which will necessarily sustain this élan once Mr. Jackson fails to win the nomination. History of messiahs in all the religions of the world is that when they lose their appeal for one reason or another, when they can no longer produce the sense of victory, they can't ever produce the victory, but when they produce the sense of victory which they promise, people lose a great deal of faith and the community turns in on itself, which would be unfortunate for the black community in America. But this much is true, I think, that America does not yet as know how to handle someone who comes from an oppressed people and to judge them by the same standards of character and of responsibility which we would judge any other candidate. And one of the unfortunate things, from my point of view, of this campaign has been that Mr. Hart and Mr. Mondale have been so reticent in saying straight out to Mr. Jackson, you ought to be repudiating Mr. Farrakhan. You ought to be making some very clear statements about the way you speak about Jews and the Jewish people. You ought to make it very clear that you stand for the things you claim to stand for, this rainbow coalition, peace, justice, and humanity. But they have been leery to do so. And when they have spoken, it has been because really the media has in fact forced them to do so. What Mr. Jackson's role will be in the Democratic National Convention, it is hard to say. But more important, I think, in terms of the long pull is what he says after the convention and after the election. Whether he becomes mean-spirited in a very open way, or whether somehow the decency which one hopes is within him comes to the fore and he begins to discover what it really means to be a minister, a healer, a peacemaker, and one who understands. What should Jews be doing? There's one thing we've learned over the long centuries, and that is that protestations of innocence, sweet reason, logic, make no impact on people who think in prejudicial terms. This is not a time when Jews have to go out to prove to any minority that we are decent people. This is not a time when we have to bend over backwards towards Mr. Jackson and join with him just in an attempt to silence him on this issue. It won't work. We should do what is right in terms of civil rights, in terms of social welfare, simply because it is right to do it. And for the rest of it, we ought to say what we think, if we think it, about Mr. Jackson openly, without compunction, but essentially to remember that who we are, to live with the dignity with which we possess. There have been other dangers to the Jewish community in the world, in the United States. There will be others in times to come. This is not a time for frenzy. It's a time to go our own way, to vote for whoever it is we care to vote for, to recognize that this is a great emotional moment for the black community, but it's a very dangerous moment for them. It's a moment in which their own leadership will be struggling with itself, with their own conscience and with their own minds, and to gain a better perception of how best to manage the next decade or two. And it's a time for us to recognize that a man can be a minister, and he can wrap himself in the robes of piety, but he may not necessarily be a good man. It's been interesting, has it not, how many of the newly powerful political figures in our world, the Ayatollah on down, have been religious figures, true believers, and men who cause sometimes great harm.